Let's roll. This is Countercharge, your podcast for ranks, flanks, and kings of war. Join your hosts as they delve into the world of Panathar and bring you worldwide coverage of all things Kings of War.
Welcome to Countercharge. I'm Luke Fraser.
I'm Keith Conroy.
And I'm Rob Fanuff, and we're back again with the final installment of this series we've had on scenarios. This time we're, it's fair to say these are the ones that no one really plays competitively, right? We're talking about kill and bluff tokens.
Bluff tokens have been seeing a little play in the PNW. There's been like a little bit of a renaissance over the last year. And I wish I knew who was responsible for that, because I've come around on them a little bit.
We have one or two in the Northeast, but it's more of the exception than it is the rule.
You know, we sort of play kill anyways, because depending on the scoring system you're using, there's already an element of kill in most of the scoring rubrics that we have. Well, guys, it's been a while since you guys have been on. What has been going on with your hobby? What have you guys been hobbying lately?
Thankfully, over the last like 10 days have really kicked into gear. So I don't have to come to you with my hands out, just like begging for your forgiveness after the very ambitious plans I outlined last time. But yeah, I've been trimming mold lines like a madman. I'm most of the way through that. So I've got Rose City Rumble in Portland, Oregon on March 2nd and 3rd. So if anybody wants to come to Portland the beginning of March, we'd love to have you. And I decided that if I didn't get Northern Alliance like in close enough shape to play for that, then I have no idea when I would. And it would be 4 weeks before Masters. I'd be scratching my head wondering what the hell I'm going to do. So, yeah, I've got a very aggressive hobby schedule over the next like 6.5 weeks. I put recurring calendar reminders for 2 hours. Tuesday and 3 hour Thursday. So it's exciting. There's a lot of work ahead, but I've been going like crazy. So that's a good feeling.
For me, I've got Adepticon in March. And then in addition, the Blue City Brawl, which is a doubles event here in Memphis in March as well. I don't know why I did it, but I committed to, hey, I'll paint up a new 1,000-point army for in 6 weeks. So I'm in the process of doing that. And then in addition, 2 weeks after that, I've got Adepticon. Painting up 1,000 points of forces of nature, but I'm doing a theme that is like winter theme. So like water elementals will actually be played by ice elementals, right? Just to try to, maybe the druid will be an ice queen. In a way, I want to play some force of nature, but the same token, it's kind of nice to have, okay, double duty units. It's like, okay, they're water elementals in this list, but then they could also be ice elementals in my Northern Alliance army.
It's not like those two units show up in the same list anywhere. So
exactly. And that's what I was thinking. Like, I don't think anybody will have a problem with me running ice elementals in my force of nature list because they're not in the list. So, and if I have a couple of units, and as long as those are these are water elementals or whatever I want to use it for, like it'll be obvious that that's what they are. There won't be any confusion. And there'll be other things that are going to be more traditional force of nature, like I've got a Pegasus, and I have a Forest Warden and Greater Earth Elemental, and those are the traditional models.
On my agenda for this evening is to take a look and see whether I can hack the Greater Fire Elemental into another Ice Elemental, because I have five Mantic Ice Elementals, and it's the monopose, right? And like I've done some very basic, like playing with the one arm that's separate to do a little bit of extra variety out of that. But if I can hack that Greater Fire, because it's already got like some sort of like stony parts to it, and that's a paint job away from being ice chunks, right? So I'm just trimming off in Mesh Mixer some of the ice naiad bits to get some big old ice crystals, and I'll pop them in there and see what I can get.
Yeah, that'll be awesome. Keith, how about you? What have you been working on?
Yeah, so Dead of Winter's coming up this weekend. I'm kind of down to the last. Fortunately, this one's a commission army, so getting in the last couple units in, I need to like paint bases, re-glue models, kind of that whole maintenance thing before we go this weekend. And came back from Nerdhammer, so shout out to Rob Allison and the Nerdhammer crew. They put on a fantastic GT, so it's been a really good season up here for the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic.
Well, with that, let's take a quick commercial break on the other side. We're going to get into the main topic the kill and bluff token scenarios. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Tom Robinson, UK Master, and you're listening to Countercharge.
Welcome back to Countercharge, and next up we're going to finish up our discussion on scenarios. This time we're going to tackle kind of the outliers of the collection. We're going to talk kill and we're going to talk bluff tokens. And let's start with bluff tokens, because I think that is one that we do occasionally see play. Why do you think some portion of the competitive scene doesn't really like the bluff token scenario, and we don't see it maybe as often as we do the other scenarios in tournaments?
I think from a practical standpoint, just to start off, there's a lot of user error involved in this scenario. So when you're moving your models around, you know, these tokens that we get, they're pretty light, and they can flip over really easily, especially when you're moving onto them or around them, and flipping one over, you know, through no fault of anyone can really ruin the game, like knowing where a bluff token is, especially because on the scenarios, you're hiding them on your opponent's side. So if it accidentally knocks over, it kind of can ruin your plan. And also there's a lot that goes on in between the rounds and it's easy to forget. So like compared to control or dominate or some of the ones we're used to where it's like, okay, you end your turn, your opponent takes their turn. Like you go pretty, you're not really progressively scoring anything. Each of the bluff token scenarios that something happens in between turns. And if you forget those steps, which is really easy to do when you're caught up in the heat of the moment and, you know, really focused on your game, missing those steps can really ruin the scenario. And it's tough to remember sometimes.
Yeah. And I think more than anything, at least in my experience, is they're just kind of a hassle. You have to interact with them in the middle of the game, and there's 10 of them. So like the chances of one of them being under a unit or in a piece of terrain where you've got something balanced or whatever, like you just have to, you know, have to touch them in the middle of the game. And that's a great way for things to get slipped or touched. And I've got some good things to say about the gameplay, but just from a pure practicality standpoint, they're just a little bit of a hassle.
The other thing that's interesting is we've got two scenarios that are identical, with the only difference is when you flip the tokens over. To your point, Luke, you know, smoke and mirrors, that's the one where we flip them like round by round. That's okay. I prefer, if we're going to play bluff tokens, just to do fool's gold. It's at the end of three, you just, every token flips over and you see the table state. Yeah. Raise your hand if you've forgotten to flip tokens, right? If you're playing. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, warriors, yeah. Like, you're turned forward, like, oh, we should have had a couple turns of these being turned over already.
Right.
The difference between the two is sort of interesting, right? Because in both of the scenarios, you're setting up your five bluff tokens on the opponent's side of the table. So you always know where your tokens are, as long as you remember, which try to remember where your 2-point is.
Easier said than done.
Yeah, no doubt, eh? So to some extent, like the scenarios play with player agency a little bit because you have that hidden information, which is, I think, unique in Kings. Like there's no other hidden information, is there, like anywhere in the game? Like the smoke and mirrors, where you're flipping every turn, it gives each player more agency over knowing where the tokens are. Because, you know, if you've got five tokens each, you know where your five tokens are. So over the first three turns, you get way more information than you had going in. The flip side, Fool's Gold, where you flip them all end of round three, you cannot know what the ones on your side of the board are. So you have to act, or you have to leave yourself open to getting new information after the third turn. So they demand very different things.
It really punishes slower armies, because as much as we tell ourselves, you know, don't commit until turn three, or, you know, wait out and choose ideal combats, like scenario wise, it's the same thing. Like, don't commit to a token if you don't have Pathfinder and you're on the other side of a woods. And if you flip it and it's the zero, and then you have a unit that's out of the game pretty much and can't redeploy to another area.
Especially for Fool's Gold, because if there's that one stranded in the corner,
right?
You know, end of turn one, you can check it. And then if you're dwarves, you can spend the next five turns hiking your skirts up and rolling over there. But
right. Yeah. Especially pre-ordered March, you know, yeah, it's like, well, absolutely, I can never reach that token.
I guess we have to bully human infantry now.
Yeah. So playing it the first couple times is fun, but then it can lend itself definitely into like, okay, tokens on opposite ends of my opponent's corners, which one's which, and then, you know, deciding which one to go for, that novelty can kind of wear off. I'll add in too, for the practical standpoint, because it's a very specific token, that comes in a Mantic like add-on, like the peripherals. Not everyone would have it. So if you're a TO, it's kind of on you to be like, make sure you bring them or buy them or to have extra sets and provide them just in case. And they're really easy to lose because they look exactly like the other ones, like the treasure tokens. And that set comes, they're beautiful tokens, but it comes with a lot. And if you miss one out of the set, you can't play them, right? Because it doesn't add up anymore. So
you got to have zeros, twos, ones, and you got to have it for both players. And there's 10 of them. I feel bad for TOs that run that at their events because I'm sure they have to have multiple sets just available for the players that don't have them.
Yeah, my original set is missing one of the 1 points. So, I mean, they're fine objector tokens now, but useless bluff counters. Shout out to Nate Murray for my complete set of Jackalopes-themed bluff counters that I use now.
Nice. They do make good tournament swag.
That's the kind of swag that I like, is when you give me things that I can use in-game or things that mm-hmm. I really can't buy, custom things that remind me of your event. You know, that widgets, I'm all about widgets, man. If you can give me some cool widgets, I can buy models, but creative widgets, that's some good stuff right there. Let's just talk about the scenario a little bit, you know, and how, you know, this style of scenario is so different than the other ones we've already talked about. You know, we talked about, like, we called it like area control, where the ones where you're trying to dominate a part of the map, whether it's like invade or dominate or control. Then we had the ones where we had loot tokens, right, where you're picking up a loot token. So this bluff token pair of scenarios, how is it different? Because I think you're right, Luke. I think it plays a lot differently. It's not just the randomness of or the hidden information. It's almost like you have to have an element that can react in this one, because sometimes you get the information late and you've got to be able to adjust. But
yeah, I mean, with 10 tokens on the table, like the board is pretty dense with potential points, right? So if your plan going into these scenarios is to sort of spread out and contest most of the board, you're already, like, you're not as badly affected as someone that wants to play a really hard denied plank, say. And because you should always know where your tokens are, you can always deploy with that in mind. Now, these tokens really want you to try to do weird, goofy mind games. And I would maybe encourage you to lean into that slightly more absurd playstyle. Like it's probably not the right, you know, reliable tournament victory choice. But, you know, if you want to treat these as more almost narrative, then that's one way to do it, where you put your 2-point token on the same flank that you deny. So your opponent says, well, obviously that's not the 2-pointer. And then after turn three, you flip it and you both go, what? So that's, you know, some top level competitive advice from your US master here. Now, the other thing I'll say is that other than raise, these are about as close as Kings gets to sort of mid game scoring. So, you know, they're obviously not progressive scenarios like other games use, but because the available information changes in some cases radically during the game, they can really change player priorities for which parts of the board you want to contest. And therefore, they change player behavior mid-game, which is somewhat unique in King's scenarios. So I would encourage you to try to appreciate them from that perspective.
And if you played Stratego as a kid, you'll love this game even more, which I was terrible at. I would always stare down my most important pieces and never caught on, as my brothers would win every single time against me until I got fed up and never played it again.
Hell yeah.
I would say, too, that the what makes this different, the mobility, the speed, like this is the herd. This is the Order of the Green Lady. This is where your flying heroes really shine. They're not loot tokens, they're objectives. So you can always, you don't need to pick anything up, which is great, because if it was 10 loot tokens, then it would really be a slow game. But because you can say, oh, sorry, it's turn three, this clearly wasn't the one you wanted, I'm going to hop over you and get to the one that's good. It really does benefit a fast army with Pathfinder, something with Nimble, now Ordered March to some extent. That sense of mobility is really important to have.
And unfortunately, that mobility is already really rewarded in basically every other aspect of the game. So yes. It's, I don't know that I really think it's a doubling down of that advantage, but it definitely reinforces it.
We used to have some progressive scoring scenarios, and this is kind of the last that's left of those. The between rounds, checking to see things like pausing the clock, okay, flip your token, flip all the tokens. This is sort of the last of those.
So what do you guys think is the purpose of these scenarios? Because obviously it was a conscious effort on their part to bring bluff tokens to the game in third edition, I assume to mix it up. But from your perspective, what do you think was the purpose of adding this type of scenario?
I assume Mantic wanted zany mind games injected into the scenario pack. Because, I mean, a lot of the rulebook scenarios previously were like, I don't want to say bland because I love dominate and control, but they're a little bland, right? It's very, very straightforward, just sort of like contesting areas of the board. Everyone knows what they have to do and where they have to be on turn six. So introducing that fog of war element is definitely interesting on paper.
Yeah, if you think that's bland, you should have been with us with first edition, where we only had pillage, kill, and kill / pillage. We only had three scenarios, and none of them were really good. I mean, pillage was fine. Yeah, it was killage. Yeah, it was an interesting time. So I was very glad to see second edition drop with more scenarios. And over the years, they've adjusted and added and taken some out and put some in with Clash of Kings rule books. But Keith, you know, what do you think the purpose of the scenarios are?
I think it's a dynamic scenario. I believe it was originally created to kind of separate it from other like stagnant movement scenarios, such as dominate or invade, where you know where you're going to end up at the end. You need to be in the circle. You need to be on your opponent's side and to some degree in control. You need to be in the table quarters. And this one is open. Like, you don't know where you're going to be by the end of the game. So it's kind of a, all right, we'll figure it out by turn three or by the end of the game. You know, it kind of tests your adaptability, your creativeness. Like, can your plan change? And that level of thinking for that, I love the scenarios for that. But the practicality of it, the logistics, the remembering can be really tough, especially for new players and tournaments on a clock. I do want to give a shout out to Greg Person. During our summer campaign, he created a variation with the bluff tokens called Trick or Treat. So if he ever posts those, I think they're on -28, but probably one of my favorite scenarios they've ever played. It was awesome. So definitely check that out. Combining the bluff tokens, creating them as loot tokens, and then penalties. Like, is it a trick? Is it a treat? Fantastic scenario.
Well, you guys are the masters. If you're going to play this scenario, what are some tips and tricks to being successful?
Think about the table before you put your tokens down. Like, you know your army list, what its strengths are, how good it is at moving around, and especially relative to your opponent's list, you know, figure out who has the mobility advantage. You know, if your opponent has 3 flying generals and 3 Pegasus wizards, they're going to be extremely good at darting around the board. So don't try to get too fancy. But conversely, if you have the 6 flying scoring heroes, you know, you can get away with really scattering the valuable tokens around the table so that no matter how the game itself plays out in terms of killing things, scoring still happens at the very end. So take advantage of what you know to place the tokens in areas that you hope will be better for you than for your opponent, which could still be sort of bad for you. But if it's bad for you and terrible for your opponent, that's a marginal advantage for you. Same thing with terrain. You know, if you have lots of Pathfinder, put them in the woods. If your opponent has lots of Pathfinder, stick them in the open. So, you know, size up what the table is like, who has relative advantages for mobility and terrain, and place them accordingly. After they're placed, remember where they are.
That's my problem. I always forget. And then the person tips over, I'm like, oh, crap, I put the 2 over there? Geez.
Yeah, we like to think of raise as being like this intense scenario, like, oh, you got to remember what to do. Like, doesn't hold a candle to the bluff scenario token ones. You're like, oh, there's a lot going on.
Yeah. And I guess try not to be completely transparent for where your tokens are. You know, like, don't telegraph too hard your game plan. But depending on your ability to reposition mid-game, you may not have much choice. So you know half of where you need to be at the end of the game, so play accordingly, and keep an eye out for the unknown tokens on your half of the board. Try to watch your opponent's deployment. They know as much as you know, but in reverse. So, like, the mind games element is kind of not real. Like, the fake outs just don't really make sense when you get right down to it. Glean the information you can, and don't overcommit to a corner of the board when there's only one token.
Be open to changing your strategy. So leave yourself options. Like, if you have the ability to, like, okay, I'm going to position myself here so that by turn 3 or 4 or 5, when for smoke and mirrors, when the majority of the tokens are going to be revealed, like, I can go for either one. So be wary of committing too early, especially if it's around an obstacle or a piece of impassable terrain where you can't get back in time for turn 6 if it ends up being a dud. So, be mindful of that before committing.
One question I do have is, with this scenario being so unique compared to everything else, I'm assuming that it does have the potential to affect, what kind of units and your army composition, if you are considering, if you're going to a tournament that you know are going to play a bluff token scenario. So, how would you guys account for bluff tokens, when you're making an army?
Not at all, really. Like, they're just objectives. The more mobility you have, the better. But again, that's basically true game-wide. So I would be much happier with a list that I'm familiar and comfortable with than trying to build around it. In my mind, it's not like a loot token where it's really worth thinking about the penalties it's going to inflict on you. Just do your best, right?
Yeah, it's a rich get richer kind of scenario. Like, hey, yeah, I got a lot of fast mobile units that can redeploy. Excellent. I was going to take those anyway. Yeah. Right? This is your unit strength 1 flying heroes, or somewhere out there, your dragons that are collecting dust on your shelves.
Beast of nature.
You're starting to dust them off because they're unit strength 2. This is the scenario for them. Yeah. There's no greater feeling than like, hey, this was my 0. Now I'm going to fly back over you and go claim the ones while you have to turn around and spend 2 turns coming to chase me.
I guess you wouldn't really consider these scenarios, given that they are at so few events, if you're building an army, right? Because, you could probably count on one hand the number of tournaments that I've seen these scenarios at. Not very many. I don't think we've ever used them at Masters or Adepticon. I'm sure there's some out there. Going back to the question we talked about before, what was the purpose? I think there was probably some design to maybe give – it's not quite asymmetric, but it's more random and more weird. I don't know. It's hard to put it, but it's something for the more narrative bent in us. It
has a little more razzle dazzle.
Yeah. And it's that element of the chance and that randomness, which is why we voted out of the Masters and why it's not at a lot of the GTs because of that reason, because, it takes away the player skill component and 50-50, is this the 2 or is this a 0? It adds that level of chance in a game that already has chance and we're trying to mitigate.
I see some similarity between this and Salt the Earth in the sense that, if we're having a scoring system where the margin of victory is defined by how many tokens you get versus your opponent, and you have a scenario like Salt the Earth where a person can knock out 3 of them right on the first turn if they want. Sort of the same situation. The person can kind of play these, their 5 known tokens in areas. Is that resonating with you? Like,
yeah,
it has the ability to make it hard to get max points if the other player doesn't want to let you get max points.
And with 10 different tokens in play, it's already going to be tough to get that max score anyway. If you're going to deny your opponent claiming theirs as well as getting all of yours in some of these, you need to have a ton of scoring units and you need to keep them alive. So I could see this, like Kill, that we're going to get to in a little bit, leading to a lot more draws as well if you do play it right.
And the flip side of what we just talked about, how do you consider the opponent's army? I assume it's not really concerned with necessarily the type of units or their army composition, but certainly there are some things you can have in your list that you can pull late game shenanigans on your opponent to help maybe control or contest these bluff tokens. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah, is your opponent crazy enough to plop their giant horde between two tokens and they end up being a zero and a one? Are they willing to go out of their way to confuse and bluff you to harm their own chance of winning? Because oftentimes, lucky, yes, is your opponent drinking right now? Because they might be trying to outbluff you.
Yeah. I mean, aside from, like, you know, poker table-esque sizing up your opponent, look at their list, you know, figure out who has the advantage for mobility, for terrain, because whoever has those advantages can get away with, you know, being a little wackier and still recover smoothly.
Be wary of Windblast. Frozen are really important in this kind of need to get to the objective on time sort of scenarios. So it can be really helpful for keeping your opponent from reaching the tokens. Unlike with loot tokens, all of the different special rules are in play, so you don't get any immunity for being Windblasted or Enthralled because they're all objective markers. So especially if they chose the wrong one, it could be adding a little insult to injury if, oh, I'm on the wrong token and I'm getting Windblasted away. So that gives a lot of benefit. So if you want a Trixie style tier list and you have all these cool rules for Enthrall and Windblast and Frozen that you're not often getting to use because you've been playing too many loot scenarios, try some bluff token scenarios, and I think you'll have a lot more fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we didn't mention, but, you know, there's 10 tokens. For each player, there's a 2, 2 ones, and 2 zeros. You place them on your opponent's side of the board, and they place them on your side of the board. And really, the only difference between Smoke and Mirrors and Fool's Gold is when you actually flip these over. Fool's Gold, at the end of round 3, they all get flipped. And in Smoke and Mirrors, at the end of each round, you pick one of your opponent's token to flip over. But other than that, they're exactly the same. And, you know, obviously, bluff tokens are zero, aren't worth anything, and you know, that's the hope, is that the enemy has, you know, you're hoping that you've bluffed them into going for something obvious. Oh, that's an obvious going to be a 2. And then they flip it over and it's a 0. And you've got some 2 way in the back. And your, you know, Pegasus Rider goes, or Beast of Nature goes and get it, you know, on turn 5 or 6. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on what could you think we could do to improve these scenarios. They are kind of wacky and random, but is there something we could do to maybe normalize them a little bit, to make them where they could fit into more of a competitive landscape?
I'd like to see a variation of these where you use, instead of having them be objective markers, because it kind of, it sometimes it can feel a little bit more of the same, like, okay, now it's turn 3. This is just like I'm playing Pillage with varied amounts. But include a variation that instead of objective markers, they're loot tokens. So you actually have to pick them up. You're not punishing the slower armies as much. And there could be some fun variations with that, of differing amounts or penalties for holding them. I think there's some ways to reward the use of a, like a surprise element, like that chance that you have with the bluff tokens, but still making it so that you're not punishing slow armies that are already punished in this game.
Yeah. I mean, you could play around with, what happens when you flip the token. Because right now you flip it and it just becomes an objective worth that much, and that's open information. But you know, if you had something like when you flip a 0 point token, every unit within 3 inches gets to heal, you know, 6 wounds or something. Suddenly, if you're sitting on top of that low value token, well, maybe that's such a bad thing. Now again, that probably just further leans into the advantage that fast armies have, but. Yeah, the more things that happen, scenario-wise, the more things that happen in the middle of the game, the happier I'll be, at least until I figure out why that's bad.
You know, if you look back at scenarios that we've had in the past, we had one where you flipped the token over and you didn't know. It was random how much it was going to be worth. And they obviously got rid of that one because it was really random, right? At least this one, you do control half the tokens, right? You do have some player agency in terms of where you put those tokens. Those are the ones that essentially you know that you can go get, right? And that you're kind of, in some ways, forcing the hand of your opponent to, these are the ones you know where they are, and you're hoping that they don't guard the right ones. And, you know, so I don't know. It's interesting. I would like to see it played a little bit more in competitive events, but I can see why we don't. We have 14 scenarios. And we only play 5 or 6 in a tournament. So I get it. You know, I totally get it, that why there's maybe better ones to play.
And I would like to see more of it too, because I feel like Surge armies in this this latest version are a little bit more punished because now there's more loot. We're skewing more towards loot tokens and push and carrying so many loot tokens. It's really tough for Surge armies to kind of compete in those. So having more that have the objectives, like this is great for a Surge army because you have that mobility, you have that ability to surge onto different objective markers, and you know, you're not being penalized by picking up tokens, but we never play these ones. So they kind of get chaffed a little bit by not being able to participate in these ones as often.
And for those that may be hearing this going, oh, I don't like that scenario, let me just set the stage. We used to have a scenario called Ransack, where you place D3 tokens on the table, pillage tokens. When you picked them up, you roll the D3, and that's what it was worth.
I remember that.
There's worse, more non-deterministic scenarios in our past.
Count your blessings, eh?
Yeah. The very first GT we went to for Kings of War, Unplugged GT, and I played that scenario versus Kevin Spear. And I'd like to say that I won because, you know, just masterful tactics. But he had put a large flying hero behind an impassable terrain and forgot about it for the entire game until we were picking up and like, oh, here's my giant flying character I forgot about behind this giant tower. And so, you know, lots of skill.
People that want to see some of the really fun, quirky scenarios should really check out Clash of Kings 2017. I mean, we had some doozies, right? We had Eliminate. That's, everybody hates Eliminate, right? Hates it so much that I made him play it at Kings of Memphis last year. And I got so much bitching. They're like, oh my God, it's so terrible. Because let me Eliminate, right? You're trying to kill a unit. I get it.
Oh, yeah.
It was, you know, Ransack's one. Then we had one called Secure, where you're actually trying to hold certain terrain features on the table. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys remember that one. And then there were Scour and Scavenge. So, yeah, if you have the Clash of Kings 2017 book, you should go check it out.
I remember Eliminate. We had all come over from playing Warhammer Fantasy. So we were all used to like, yeah, well, I'm going to make a Death Star unit, right? I'm going to take the most expensive horde that I can. I'm going to give it the best item. And, like, this is how I win. So Eliminate was like, oh, crap, now that's a target. Now everyone really wants to kill that unit, and if I lose it, I lose.
Because you're trying to eliminate the most expensive unit in the army against you, right? And so you're like, all right, make it easy. I wanted to kill it anyways. Now I'm going to win the game because of it. I'm excited to see what the future holds with bluff tokens. You know, hopefully we can maybe get some tournaments to work it in the system. I mean, because it does scratch a different itch than some of the other more traditional cut and dry scenarios.
They're not straightforwardly terrible, that's for sure.
Let's take another quick commercial break. On the other side, we're going to get into everybody's favorite scenario.
I'm Chris Pelletier, Nick Sabetta's worst nightmare, and this is Countercharge.
Welcome back to Countercharge. This is the one scenario that's been around since first edition, and it gets played the least. Back when we only had pillage, kill, and as Luke dubbed it, killage, we did play kill back then, but since then, very rarely do we play kill. Because I guess, really, if you think about it, we're playing kill on some level in almost every scoring system we have, whether it's Northern Kings and their kill points or their attrition score that's based in blackjack. Well, just talk to me about kill, guys. What are your general feelings about kill?
Trash.
It's really hard to get a high score in kill. And if you're playing kill and you've got a 20-0, 21-0 in blackjack or in some of these scoring systems, it usually means that you just beat up your opponent. And it kind of represents a lopsided game more so than any of the other scenarios, I'd argue. So newer players, right? You're playing control, you're playing loot. It's like, man, I lost the game, but I held onto a loot token, right? Like I got a table quarter and I scored some points and like I own that and I'm going to get better. But if you lose big and kill, man, it's so demoralizing because you just got all your, everything has just been killed. And it encourages a cutthroat kind of play style of like, all right, you're already killing me. And instead of like taking your points and backing off, you're just chasing down every single wizard that's running across the board and trying to get them for max points, which in a competitive setting is fine. But for a newer player, I can imagine how gut-wrenchingly awful kill must be if it's your first or second scenario and somebody just comes and takes every single toy that you have from you.
Feels like getting kicked while you're down, eh?
Let's talk about, from a competitive sense, you know, why fundamentally most competitive players do not like kill. Let's talk about that.
For a scenario named kill, more often than not, you end up with more draws and small wins and small losses. Because with scoring system, it's really hard to not only kill your opponent's pieces, but preserve your own, and can lead to more games of, instead of kill, I'm going to play run away, or I've killed just enough of my opponent that I'm going to disengage and chaff and, you know, back off compared to a scenario which you would think would be more about chasing things down and, you know, bloody combat and clashes. It spoke to Alex Kuss about it, and he said that when he's run it before, more so than any other scenario, this is the one that generates the most draws. And, you know, 16 fives and 14 sevens in blackjack. It can lead to some boring games too, especially if you're up ahead in the standings and you're like, well, I only need to get a draw. It's easier to get a draw and kill than it is in many of the other scenarios, I'd argue.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it just doesn't exert outside pressure on the players. So it's not interesting. So I don't like it. Like, you know, no matter what the game is, you want to pick up your opponent's pieces without picking up your own, right? That's how you win really every game of Kings of War, or at least how you try. So being scored purely on that, it doesn't create any other priorities, which are really good at breaking like just weird and unpleasant playstyles and habits. You know, shooting, backing up 3 inches with your Gladestalkers and shooting again in kill, that's a great plan a lot of the time. If you have to get across the midline like an invade, well, you're paying in tempo for that advantage in attrition. So yeah, losing the tension that other scenarios bring to the game is just nuts. Like why would you want to lose that kind of incentive structure?
Right. If you're gonna back off and shoot my unit with the loot token, well, now the loot token's dropped and you may not necessarily be able to grab it, right? There's always something that kind of balances it. But here, yeah, you can back off and shoot as much as you can, and it rewards hiding and it can reward gun lines. Absolutely.
Kind of riffing on what you said, Luke, though, I think you're right. I think it's not interesting. All the other scenarios, there's an element of kill there. If you want to kill their opponent, you can do it, right? But there's other variables, other knobs you can twist and turn, whether it's trying to get loot tokens, whether it's trying to outbluff your opponent, whether it's to get to the dominate circle. Those are all, none of that's there in kill.
Yeah.
All you have is just, let's just line up and shoot each other, smash each other up. And it's a pure, you know, unit trading or piece trading game. And at that basic level, I don't know how interesting it is.
Yeah.
The armies that rely on chaff or like layering their forces, knowing that they're going to give some up, like that piece trading kind of component, like you start off with attacks, right? And so many of our games end up with like, you have 3 units left, I have 2. After all that work, you just kind of end up at a draw anyway, right? Because like if it's between like 500 points difference, yeah, that's usually how most of the games work, but it's much more dynamic and interesting to have, well, but this unit has all these tokens and is running away and I'm like protecting it at all costs versus like, okay, we killed each other. There's a couple things left. All right, let's tally it up. You know, it's sort of anticlimactic at the end.
Yeah, and from a purely competitive standpoint, like for experienced players, Kings is a pretty simple game, right? Like it plays smooth. We know, you know, what the stat lines do and how they interact. So without an additional structure provided by a scenario to put, you know, conflicting and competing priorities and demands on the players, it just doesn't have that much to offer. Like I almost look at the core game as a framework to have a fun game, and kill for me is not that framework.
It's understandable, right? It's just not as complicated.
Absolutely.
Kings is a very streamlined, I guess the better word, is a streamlined game system. And, you know, you go into kill, it's like, the interest with Kings of War is when you add interesting scenarios, right? Like that's, you want to add interest to the, you know, add a little more flavor to the game. That's, you do that through scenarios. So I totally get it. And Keith, you're right. You know, the fact that you end up with a bunch of draws, right? Like very rarely do you get like someone just wiping somebody out.
Yeah. And when you do, it's a feel bad scenario. It's somebody got picked on or something went really wrong.
And you could argue that it really, if we were to play kill more often, it does incentivize gun lines.
Mm-hmm.
Other scenarios decentivize it. Right? Oh, you got to get loot tokens. You've got to do these other things.
Yeah.
You got to get to the invade. You got to move. You gotta, right. Whereas kill is like, no, I can just sit back and just shoot. What makes this style of scenario unique when you look at the pantheon of these 14 scenarios that we have? What makes this one stand out? And not necessarily in a good way, right?
Well, this is the great equalizer, right? This is at the end of the day, right? At the end of the GT, did you bring enough models that can actually kill things? Right? Did you bring an entire army of Earth Elementals? Did you bring a bunch of anvils that were going to sit on tokens and play scenarios and regen and heal and not die? Which is great for a lot of the other scenarios. But at the end of the day, did you bring something that can kill your opponent? And that's what kills for. And I made that mistake. When I went to the Nerdhammer GT, I hadn't played since my daughter was born. So I was like a kid in a candy store. I'm like, oh, I want one of this from Night Stalkers and this, and I'm going to do the wind blast and enthrall, and I'm going to shoot people, and I want a Shadow Hulk. And so when I brought it to the table, I'm like, oh, I don't have enough volume of attacks. I can't kill anything. I played against Michael Ireland's Ratkin, and I just, you know, he's like, okay, that's cute, and just moved everything up and killed all my stuff. I'm like, no, but I needed to do this combo, and I wanted to wind blast you here so I could enthrall you here. And at the end of the day, I'm like, I couldn't kill anything, you know. Two order of the Green Lady Alpha Strike armies were just like, all right, cool, you wind blasted one unit, and they charged and killed everything, and that was the game. So at the end of the day, it serves as that check, right? Like, can I kill my opponent's stuff, or am I wasting too many points in fun, tricksy shenanigans? And it's always good to have in the back of your mind when you're creating a list. You got to remove your opponent's stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I relentlessly bully anyone locally that tries to run it. So I don't, as a result, I don't have to deal with it that much. But it does demand a certain level of honesty from lists. You know, you get into those really, really extreme goblin lists, for example, that intend to throw away 12 or 1500 points in the course of their victory. They just like cannot get a big win in a scenario like this. So, you know, I guess if I'm being generous, I would say kill gently nudges list building towards a more like sort of neutral and almost like normal style of list, sort of what you envision when you think of a fantasy army, rather than some of the more extreme goofy skews that are available in the game. But I'm not feeling that generous. So nah, kills bad. Skip it.
Once played a 2,700 point army at an event where I took all Fleabag Riders.
Okay.
I went 3-2. There was a game where I won, but I didn't kill anything in the entire game because the whole army was designed to take troops to Fleabags and right. just stop you. But that's all I did. Like, I just rushed them up and I just wave after wave, but like in kill, that army wouldn't do so well because it doesn't do anything. It just gets in the way.
And that's the other thing is I would love to see that stupid army once, at an event. So if the scenarios are discouraging insane stuff like that, well, what are we even doing here, right?
From that end, every scenario we have will influence the type of armies that will show up at the sure. event, right? I mean, and same thing with the scoring systems. Some are more hands-on and some are maybe more subtle. The threat of kill is a good thing to be out there. Because if people think there might be kill at some point, you know, it's in the back of their mind. To your point, Luke, it's more, I'm going to call it an honest list, right? Like a more, is it balanced? I don't know if the word balance is right, because you could take a skew list that's just all guns yeah. and stuff. But it's going to definitely, a fighty list, right? Because it does, there are armies you could make that would, and I've proven that point, that are very terrible at killing other people's units. The reality, though, is that we play sort of kill in most scoring rubrics anyways. Mm-hmm. So you're already kind of, you know, in that. So in that tournament, I didn't, all my wins were, they were all like middle of the yep. road because I got yep. the scenario points, but I got no attrition. In fact, if we played, I think we were playing Northern Kings. If we would have been playing Blackjack, I would have been having negative, right? So right. I would have had 15 or whatever it is. I'd be going down. Because I was losing. I mean, in one, I think I lost 2,200 points on my army. Like, it was, you know, it was insane.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Rob, is that attrition scoring is in most of the scenario scoring packs anyway. So having the scenario section double down on attrition, what are you doing? What's going on here?
Yeah, you know, it's like Blackjack has this scenario element and then this attrition score.
Yeah.
You eliminate one half of the rubric when you just play kill.
Now it's more attrition. Attrition yeah. times two. Yeah, and make sure you do that. Kill is unique in the fact that it's really the only scenario that rewards bringing individuals. So if you're a triple vampire, Morgoth, a faceless kind of guy or gal, this is your scenario, right? Because it doesn't matter if they're scoring units. Those points that you have tied up in mounted individuals that can fly away or are a pain in the butt to deal with, or you have your elven archmage, which may or may not have been mounted with boots of levitation, not so much anymore. This is awesome, right? Because you get to keep your points. Doesn't matter if they're scoring or not. It's just that, all right, I have 600 or 700 points in characters like Twilight can. And if you can't kill them, I'm going to preserve those points. So there's that benefit. If you like individuals, this is your scenario.
Speaking of areas where Kings of War really shines as an interactive game, nothing like high-powered combat individuals to make you want to tear your hair out.
Yeah, just ones that fly and cast drain life on you.
Yeah, nothing like going back to early second edition when we didn't have unit strength. And yeah, you know, we were playing Dominate, and it was the cost of the units in the circle is what you scored. Yeah. One of the first or second UK Masters, triple vampire mounted list, just ran roughshod over everybody because what are you going to do, right? You ain't going to kill them. They were D6 back then, too. So, no, good luck. The more we talk about it, the less I like kill.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah. We're doing our job.
Yeah.
I came into this going, you know, you sort of have to have the threat of kill just to keep maybe some of the type of army compositions in check. You know, it's sort of if there's the threat of kill, it forces people to consider it, okay? Well, right. And maybe make some adjustments, right? But we already are doing that by having an attrition score as part of the rubrics.
Sometimes the medicine is worse than the symptom.
I mean, what are your tips for playing kill?
I mean, if you want to get really into it, if you have a copy of your opponent's list and a copy of yours as you're playing and things are dying, you can jot down some points and some totals. If you wanted to. It seems like a lot of work and a little excessive, but yeah, and then you can figure out when you're winning and when's a good time to run away or when's a good time to commit, you know, having that knowledge. But if you're playing as just a general good rule of thumb, right, if it's turn 4 or 5, look at your graveyard, look at your opponent's graveyard and kind of make a mental note of like, okay, where do I stand right now? Is this a time where I need to like start throwing chaff to like protect my high scoring points units, or is this a time where I really need to go all gas, no brakes, right, and destroy and get as many points as I can? So it's good to always be aware when playing kill of what the point totals are, whether it's specifically writing them down or just making mental notes and checking between each round of like, okay, this is about what they have and this is about what I have.
Why doesn't Companion do this for us? If we're using the Companion app to run a tournament, they have my list, they have my opponent's list. Why can't I have like a checkbox to show what was killed so I don't have to pull my calculator at the end of the game? Just tell me what I killed and give me the attrition score.
That's an amazing idea. That's fantastic. Yeah. And just like check the box. It's like, all right, you prayed against this list. As the units die, you just check the boxes at the end of the game. All the totals and everything's calculated for you.
Same question to you, Luke. You know, what tips do you have for playing kill? I mean, you must not have any since you don't ever play it because you've browbeat everybody around you to not play it. But certainly you're a genius, so you've got some idea. If you had to play it, what would you do?
Yeah, well, I mean, usually the pressure to act in a game comes from a combination of who has the longer threat ranges, who has more shooting, and what the scenario demands. So if you remove the scenario element, then it really just comes down to who can force the opponent to do stuff. So kill, you want to, you know, kill your opponent's pieces without losing any of your own. So you really want to be fast and hard hitting so you can really dictate the flow of the battle. And like an Alpha Strike list, if it has to contest a loot token, you know, it has to make hard choices. Without those hard choices, you engage only when you know you have the advantage. And the same applies to shooting. You know, shooting is the best way to remove enemy pieces without losing any of your own, right? So even if it's not doing good damage, you can just risk nothing while slowly gaining an advantage. So basically build boring lists.
If you have Alpha Strike, don't commit till turn 5 or 6. Kill stuff. Maybe they hit back a little bit, win the game. The threshold for the base book is only 200 points, But I believe every other scoring system, it's like a 455. Yeah.
Yeah, it's 10%. So a 2,000 point game would be 200 points. But you know, I'm wondering, you guys, as I hear you guys talk, does Kill devolve the game into more of a list building game, aka it's all about the matchup because it's removed the scenario play out of it?
I think it probably makes the matchup question worse overall. I assume it mitigates it in some areas, but yeah, like at the beginning of a game, you need to look at, this is sort of game wide, who is forced to act, right? If your opponent has a gun line and you don't, you simply have to cross the table and suffer the damage that they're going to inflict on you in order to engage. Because if you don't, they will just shoot you off the table, and then turn six, they'll score. The scenario pressure is an additional factor that controls who has to act and when. So if you take away that pressure provided by, you know, getting across the midline or carrying tokens, then without having thought about it a lot, I would say, yeah, that means that the sort of pure matchup, who has the longer range, more aggressive tools, has a larger advantage than they would with other factors to consider.
It also benefits list building if you're not a list that relies on chaff or trading pieces. And I think that Kill really punishes that play style. Like if I already know most games, right, I'm going to lose my harpies, I'm going to lose my gargoyles. I have these units that their whole purpose is to die, so that I can gain the advantage for scenario. Like you're already starting off on the back foot. And I think that that can be tough for some lists to and players to navigate.
As you're describing this, all I keep thinking is, I don't want to play Warhammer.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, I know they had a few others, but by and large, it was Kill, right? And mm-hmm. You know, and the more you talk about it, the more I'm like, this is Kings of War, and you guys have taught me out of it. I don't like Kill anymore. I had a small little like maybe every once in a while, but now I'm like,
honestly, I mostly don't even do Kill for demo games anymore. Like, you know, we sort of, you know, take it easy and just sort of clash in the middle anyway, but just, you know, having that mentality of we are fighting over something, there is a reason to be somewhere on the table at a time. Like that's so core to the identity of the game for me. It doesn't make sense to just fight.
If you're trying to showcase Kings of War, you don't want to show them Kill. You want to show them that the Kings of War is about scenario play. You know, it's about movement, deployment, strategy, scenario play. It's those things. It's not about who created the most powerful list with Death Stars, right? Because yeah. So I 100% agree that if you're going to show somebody a new game, something simple,
control.
Yeah.
Something that shows that you can win the game without killing. You can hold people off and still win the scenario, which I think is much more interesting.
I have always found it really, really satisfying and rewarding when I realize that I've messed up scenario. Because for me, that's like a real clear sort of learning point. It's like, oh, I got carried away. I wasn't paying attention to the scenario, and now I'm going to lose. So in the future, I need to be thinking further ahead and paying more attention to this. It's, you know, it's more to think about. It's more game to play when you get right down to it.
Does Kill affect your army composition or, you know, thinking about your army or what you're playing against?
It can make you think twice if you want to chase down your opponent's cheap wizards, you know, that are throwing, you know, it's like you have to make tough decisions during the game. So if you have a bunch of cheap characters, it's like, all right, go ahead and kill them. They're not worth any points and they're still contributing, like goblins. But yeah, take expensive individuals. If you know you're going to play Kill at a GT, go for it. This is the time to do it because you're not penalized for it.
It's interesting though, Keith, what you just said, because Kill is probably the one scenario where it may benefit you to kill some of those killy individuals that aren't going to help them in scenario play, but in Kill, they might be worth a couple hundred points, right? Like, or 150, yeah. You know, so, relatively easy, and maybe not vampires, but you know, so things you wouldn't normally kill and like dominate. Yeah, you know, sure, why not knock them out? You guys have a way to make it any better? Like, is there something we could tweak to make Kill more interesting?
Wildwood GT in near Portland in November. Our Dustin Church, yeah, lovely Oregonian. He had a modified, because Wildwood uses all, they're not fully custom, but they're sort of tweaked rulebook scenarios. And the one for Kill is whenever a unit participated in a kill in Melee, it got a token. I don't remember what it was called, like a Bloodlust token or something. And Bloodlust tokens were worth extra attrition at the end of the game. But you only get them for killing in Melee, and if you kill a unit with tokens, you take their tokens. So I think there was a new record for like 27 Bloodlust tokens scored at the end of the game. So it's a massive swing, and also it does that changing of priorities in the middle of the game. If an opponent's unit has five tokens on it, killing it is like way more valuable now. And similarly, keeping it alive is way more valuable. So rather than just the straight up sort of points they're worth according to their stats, the situation and the position and the history of the game will influence priorities throughout. So it's better, that's for sure. I don't know if it's good, but better.
Yeah, kill makes such a good, in the variations of kill specifically, makes such good narrative play scenarios. You know, like extra bonus points for killing this character, assassinating a wizard, or you know, targeting certain units. Like, those are the good narrative scenarios that you want to see. I don't know if there's an easy answer for kill. You know, it's, sometimes you feel like you need to have it because the amount of emphasis that are placed on like surviving and carrying tokens and running away with tokens. Like, I see the appeal of having a scenario where like, okay, you just need to kill things, like back to basics. Like, this is the point of the game. But now I'm leaning more towards, well, it's the secondary objective for every scenario is to make sure you're denying your opponents. So I wouldn't miss it if it was gone in fourth edition and replaced with something that just was entirely new. I think we're at the point where all the tournaments now are using attrition points that we'd be fine without kill.
I wasn't sure how long you could spend on bluff and kill to, you know, kill, because like I said, we don't get a lot of mileage out of it in events, but I think you guys hit on a couple of things. I think, you know, narratively or locally, I mean, occasionally it's mixes it up a little bit, especially the bluff tokens. I think there's probably potential for kill if they change it. Like what you mentioned with Dustin's event, they try to do it with Eliminate, where you had some kind of bounty to, you know, you're basically trying to get a bounty. It incentivized melee combat, because even in Eliminate, just like what Dustin did, if you shot him off the table, you didn't get it. You had to kill him in combat. You know, there's certainly some ways to maybe take kill and make it so that it doesn't push you into a gun line, you know, and I say that gun line magic and just, you know, keeping them away and just shoot them off the table before they get there. That was first edition. My first tournament of game, I played Shannon Shoemaker. I'm sure some of you know who Shannon is. He lines up on hills on the other side of the table in the deployment zone. He has a Kingdoms of Men army. He had like 8 or 9 war engines. I had an undead army, and I just shambled. It didn't cross the halfway line. 75% of my army was dead.
Shannon was playing a tower defense game.
That was one of those experiences where you walk away from it, you know, Keith said it best. It's like, feel bad. You're like, damn, dude, there's nothing I could have done. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of Balefire catapults, but I didn't have anything in the army that can outrange him. I'm already really freaking slow with all my shambling units.
And he had no reason to leave his deployment zone.
Yeah. Right. And there's no scenario to say, hey, you've got to get to the other side of the table. You have to get to these tokens.
There's none of those heroic moments of like, man, I'm losing, but I have all these loot tokens and my opponent double rolled one. And like, I ended up pulling out a draw. It's just like, man, I lost really bad. Or, yeah, we killed a bunch of stuff and we got a draw. That's usually the two ways that it goes with kill. That's about it.
Yeah, the only thing I'll say, which I didn't even realize until Keith was talking about scoring systems a minute ago, is if you are playing pure win-loss draw, then kill makes more any sense at all, right? And you can tell I'm sort of a tournament player, because it didn't even occur to me that you would be playing pure win-loss draw. You should be playing Blackjack, or if you insist, Northern Kings. From straight rulebook, I guess.
Last year at our Kings of Memphis, we actually ran a system where there was no incentive to kill. Hmm. It was pure scenario with some bonuses. And that was it. Didn't matter what you lost. Didn't matter what you killed. It was all about, did you accomplish the strategic things on the table? And that was it. I think from a standpoint of just the competitive landscape, it's good to have different rubrics, because it keeps things interesting. And I'm a firm believer that no matter what scoring system or what scenarios you play, they're going to incentivize certain types of builds, right? Just the nature of the beast. And you'll have metas to develop around that. Keel probably still has a place, not necessarily as a scenario, but as an element to a scenario, Keith, you know, as a, like a bonus objective. Maybe, yep. You know, I always like it when you have like a special character at an event. You have like this heroic, divine battle on top of the hill, you know, mano a mano.
Oh, yeah.
Opportunities where you get into these really cool clashes that are very cinematic.
Yeah, Rashad does that really well with the Riddle of Steel, and I had the privilege of going one of the best weekends ever. Highly recommend it for anybody, not even if you're on the West Coast, just if you live in the United States, Canada, or anywhere in the world, go to Riddle of Steel. But those bonuses for the kill and the if you kill this character with this character and that interaction, that's where Kill really shines, is as a bonus, as a narrative scenario, as something that adds extra flavor to the game. But as a standalone, you know, we have attrition. We're good. It's more of the same.
Yeah, I mean, even whether it's a special set of tournament rules or even just built into the core game, if as part of the game you had to, you know, nominate your general, and there were bonus points for killing a general, I wouldn't be mad. I'm not advocating for that change, but in terms of just sort of, you know, additional incentives and priorities in the game, it's something to be said.
Spoken like a true War Machine player. Rooting for the caster kill.
Oh, God.
Right, now we're talking about Death Stars and 8th, and now caster kills. Oh, God, I love Kings of War.
And the more we talk about, I'm going to air quote, the worst scenarios, they're still pretty good in comparison to some of the other stuff that's out there. So we're spoiled with so many good scenarios that we have the luxury to leave some of the ones out that we don't like.
Yeah.
Yep.
And the fact that we do have a game system that is from time to time rotating ones in. And when they don't work, a la eliminate, they get eliminated.
Yeah. Rotate them out. Try something new. It's great. That's what we love about it.
You know, closing thoughts. How would you wrap this up?
Yeah, I guess play as many different scenarios as you can stomach. I know it's very tempting, at least for me, to not want to touch a token when it's, you know, 6 p.m. on a Wednesday and you just want to make sure that you get a game in a timely, you know, a sensible amount of time. But yeah, spend the time, play those weird bluff token scenarios. Like you can do it just by using like a silver Sharpie on the bottom of a spare 25 millimeter base, right? Like they don't have to be the expensive acrylic ones. Spend a bit of time with them. You might have a surprisingly nice time. They can deliver a different experience. And especially people like me are bad for just sort of automatically defaulting towards sort of like standard, I was going to say tournament play, but in a lot of parts of the continent, that means something else. Standard sort of master's style play, just, you know, plain rulebook scenarios, straightforward scoring. And it can be rewarding and interesting to mix it up. So for the bluff token scenarios, I would say absolutely rotate them in, even to your tournaments. They're fine. They're nice. If you see them and you get a tummy ache, get over it. You're going to have a pretty nice time. If your TO insists on playing kill, then grouse about it at every opportunity. Give them no rest, no peace until they accept your way of thinking.
Well said. Pure poetry. No, that's why you label them. He says U.S. Master here. You will have so much fun playing the bluff scenarios. I like friendly pickup games. And, you know, when I have time for a game, which is few and far between these days, but the, you know, the temptation is there to like, okay, well, I'm going to play the ones that are going to be played at Masters or this upcoming GT or like practice for this. But man, like bluff token scenarios are great. If it's just a friendly game and you're hanging out, they're dynamic, there's movement, there's like that game within a game mentality that like shakes it up, like play them, try them, they're awesome. And they can be some of your most memorable and fun games. Because if you're like me, you've played the other ones to death, so mixing up a little bit and throwing the bluff token ones back in, it's good. They're a good time, but I totally get how leaving them out of a GT makes sense because of that additional element of randomness and chance can make it a little tough. And also if it's like day first day, game three or game four, and you're like, oh God, now I have to remember to flip tokens every round. Where's my token? Where did I put it? Where is the other token? Is it under a piece of terrain? Did somebody move? Is it under my unit? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of, if you're running a GT and you have control over when they're being played and you want to include a bluff scenario token, round one, round two, you know, people come back from lunch, they're caffeinated, they're on their second cup of coffee or soda. That's a good time. Don't do it round three where people are exhausted and forgetful.
That's it for us. We've covered all 14. We will come back and revisit Stockpile and Hold the Line because we only did a kind of a quick exercise into that. They weren't out very long when we did it. So we will be doing an episode in the very near future to kind of go deeper dive into those once we've had a chance to really play it. Because, I mean, I don't know about you guys. I mean, I've played them, but certainly there hasn't been a lot of events that have used it. So while I played it locally, I don't have nearly the experience to talk about it with any kind of certainty, right, or any kind of authority. So
I did get to play it at Nerdhammer, but I forgot that I was going up against an Alpha Strike Order of the Green Lady list. So I'm like, oh, I want to play the new scenario. I just did a scenario review. This is great. And then I remembered, like, oh, no, I didn't want to. I wanted the loot token one where he was going to have to pick up the loot tokens and slow his units down. And he kindly reminded me of that after the game. He's like, you know, you could have picked this one. It was better. I'm like, I know. I got really excited about the new one. And boy, did I die really quickly. But learning experience.
That's life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, awesome, guys. That's going to do us tonight. And until next time, keep countercharging.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on Countercharge. Please let us know what you thought of the show by emailing us at counterchargepodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at countercharge15, or by commenting on the Countercharge Kings of War podcast Facebook group. If you enjoy the show, you can help others find out about it by leaving positive reviews on iTunes. Until next time, keep countercharging. Music is a composition of Kevin MacLeod and is licensed under Creative Commons.